Welcome to the World of Horror Podcast, episode 111. I'm Mom.
And I'm Mac.
This is the podcast where we share our love of international horror. Fear is universal, but we are not afraid of subtitles. Okay, I'm going to stop yelling.
Oh, okay.
Wohos. This week, it is Mac's choice of genre, and Mac has chosen slashers. We reviewed Your Next from the U.S. and Tenebrae from Italy. Before we get into it, fair warning, these discussions will include spoilers and language, which may not be suitable for all listeners. Let's move on to our first segment, Mom and Mac Chat. Hi, Mac. How's it going?
Hi, Mom. It is going well, I think. My boss let me leave early today because tomorrow is a holiday, 4th of July. I guess happy birthday, America. I saw a bumper sticker over the weekend that was the American flag, and it said, if this flag offends you, you can leave. And I was like, you know, nobody's offended by the American flag, you know, like, that's stupid. Like, sure, I don't like America, but nobody looks and goes, oh, I'm offended. The news continues to be not fun to look at. And, you know, okay, now it's a little bit past this, and I know it's been talked to death. But you know what kind of made me sad was, like, you remember the whole, like, OceanGate thing? Fuck that guy, obviously, the CEO guy. Fuck him. However, you know what felt weird? Was before we found out that they had died, so we're, like, trying to, we're still waiting to see what happened to these people. I feel like everybody was just laughing. Just like,
yeah.
And it felt icky to me. Like, I just was thinking, can you imagine being a family member and, like, waiting to find out what happened, and then the whole internet is like, they're stupid, I hope they're dead, you know? It's like, that would be really fucked up. Like, again, fuck that guy. His son only went on there because he wanted to impress him, apparently, and he didn't want to go. So truly, fuck that guy. I feel so bad for the kid. Anyways, that's just been on my mind a lot. I was kind of like, I don't know. I feel like it's fine to criticize the fact that the news was only talking about that and not, like, other pressing matters in the world. But I feel like it's fair to criticize people for not having, like, a shred of human empathy, you know?
Yeah. I agree. No, I agree. I can't remember. There was some comedian who, it was a really great joke. It was about how a bunch of rich people died on the Titanic. And now a bunch of people, rich people, are going to try to go see the Titanic. And I was like, yeah, that is very strange. You know, people are strange. And, like, yeah, the sort of glee that people took in the deaths of these people was kind of troubling.
Yeah, right? In my head, I'm like, there's no winner here, though. Like, this isn't like, oh, yeah, eat the rich, and now all these things are going to change. It's like, no, nothing is changing. It's just that there's, like, a few less people in this world, and their families are going to be hurt forever by it. Like, that's what happened, you know? It's not like, oh, we got them. Like, we didn't get anything.
I actually tried to stay away from that. Sometimes there are stories that come down the pike, and I'm just like, la, 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 la. I don't want to hear anything about it. And then but I do, like, look at headlines, you know? Right before I'm trying to go to bed, which is a terrible thing to do. Don't do that. but you know, it was like the submersible had imploded. So I was just like, oh, well, okay, they're dead. But yeah, I tried to stay away from that story. I just got the feeling that it would be a real bummer. But people are not great when it comes to that. And I mean, I think it's horrible that we have such a wealth disparity in this world. That's something that's truly upsetting and horrible. And I wasn't happy to hear that they had died.
Yeah, there's no joy in that for me I mean, I know that happened like a it's old news now for this news cycle. But it's just stuff like that has been on my mind recently. Maybe I'm trying to not think about like all the horrible things, all the other ones. I don't know.
Well, speaking of news, and I don't even know if this is true, but I saw a news story that said that there are 10,000 more people in Texas than there would have been if the abortion ban hadn't been put into place. Like 10,000 more babies have been born.
Oh my God. Would
probably have been aborted if their mother, if the pregnant women had the opportunity to do so. But I was
that
just like,
so sad.
That's not good. That's going to be a problem. That is a problem.
And not many people were forced to have children. Like, yeah. That's horrible. Like,
yeah.
And I mean, who knows how many. That's the thing is, like, I feel like so many, quote, pro-life people say is like, oh, we'll just give them up for adoption. That's not like a good option. Like, I'm not saying anything against, like, I think adopting is a good thing. But it's not as if there's like a plentiful amount of people who adopt children. It's not as if it's easy or like there isn't a huge barrier of entry. Like the foster system is so fucked up. So now you're just like, here's a guaranteed amount of people who are just going to be fucked up. You know?
I feel like there's just a profound misunderstanding that we don't all exist on the same playing field. When people say things like that, like just put the baby up for adoption. I mean, and I've had like knockdown dragouts with my students over this issue. That's usually the people I'm talking to about it. But I mean, I said, okay, so that's what you would tell the 15-year-old girl who was raped by her father. Just put the baby up for adoption. And he's like, oh my God. And I'm like, yeah, see, you have to consider that there are a lot of different things going on. And that the other thing to consider is that women think very carefully about the decisions they make. It's just angering to me. It's the kind of thing that makes me really mad.
I feel like there's just a basic lack of there's a basic lack of empathy for many groups of people, but just the undercurrent of misogyny that just exists. I mean, obviously not just in our culture, but just thinking about American culture, it just is, if you think about it too much, the world seems kind of hopeless.
I know that, but I actually don't think, it's like the Supreme Court is just really fucking things up for a lot of vulnerable people. But I don't know. Maybe that's reflective of like our culture at large, but I really don't think so. I think it may be reflective of like evangelical Christians. It does seem like there are a lot of really unsympathetic people who are making decisions that affect a lot of people. But I wish I knew exactly how people felt. Like, I feel like most people are in favor of, like, abortion, for example. It's just that the people in power, they come from this very, like, weird, like, you know, tradition where, you know, abortion has to be, like, the one issue that they fight for or something like that. And I don't know how people feel towards trans people, like, at large. Like, I don't know. Like what your average person feels, if you know, if they even care, or like, I know some people care a lot and some people are probably just like, whatever, it doesn't affect me. So it's not one of my, you know, things that I'm worried about. You know, I don't know.
It's so tough also with the trans stuff, because there the wealth of misinformation out there, which is calculated misinformation, just skews all of that, because who knows how many people would maybe be just indifferent or supportive if they didn't have this like crock of shit in their head. Like,
yeah,
like there's so many people saying like, well, we can't give surgeries to minors. Well, nobody's doing that. So there you go. Oh, we can't do irreversible things to minors. Literally, they give puberty blockers to cis children. You don't care about that. Like, all these things, it's just like, you're not even right. Like, you're not even against right. things that are really happening. And so then we can't even get to the core of the issue because we have to spend all this time saying, like, that's just not true. Like, right. there's never been a case of a trans person assaulting somebody in a bathroom. Please find it for me. Oh, but you know what you can find? A lot of stories of people assaulting trans people in the bathroom, or just women getting assaulted in a bathroom by cis men. Like, it's not a thing. And that's the issue, is like these groups who are against these are dumb, but they're really smart. Like, they're really good at misleading people. And that's the yeah. fucked up thing.
It's just a series of, like, straw men arguments or straw people arguments. But, like, I heard one the other day. I mean, basically the idea is some people are against sex ed in schools because they feel like children are going to be exposed to pornography and...
Oh, brother. I mean,
it's like... If you talk to children, and then we can talk about like who actually is, like in North Carolina, nobody's talking to any children, but you know, in other parts of the country, they actually do have sex education for kids in, let's say, at least middle school and high school. There are like curricula for that. But people are opposed to, you know, like same sex being taught in a sex ed class because it's perverted or something. And it's like, that's your hang up. Like, that's your problem. Like, you have an issue because you don't understand, you know, and you have this like weird, like fascination with like, you know, gay sex or something. And it's like, it is a part of life and kids should know about it. And the thing that I heard on this podcast was that it's very important for children to be exposed to sex ed, so that way they know what's normal and isn't normal when people do things to their bodies, like when they're molested, which like 1 in 3 children are molested or something. I mean, it's a crazy statistic. So it's very important that children have knowledge of what's appropriate and not appropriate. And yet these wackos are trying to just, you know, say abstinence only is the only thing that should be taught in schools.
Yeah. And the idea that sex ed will be the thing that introduces them to pornography, when just being alive is going to get them introduced to pornography, like you really want to target something. How about we target the rampant misogyny in movies and television? Like, I feel like I had vast knowledge, not even from watching R-rated movies, just watching cable television, of like, things are so sexualized. Advertisement is sexualized. Like, you don't even have, like, there are ways for people to find porn on the internet that can circumvent, like, you know, parental controls. Like, so it's just like, you know what? They're going to be exposed. So again, you might as well show them something healthy, because if their only introduction to sex is pornography, well, that's fucked. You know, there goes their healthy knowledge about sex. Gone. You want that to be what they know? Like, you want that to be what's in their brain, is like hardcore pornography, which is all pornography is now? It's like, that's fucked. Like, you're fucked, you know? That's what you want.
I also think the misogyny is really important, because a lot of these wackadoodles, you know, want to go back to like traditional gender roles, and they want women to be, you know, have less power and less control than men in these relationships. So it's almost like it's a calculated strategy to maintain misogyny. And what I really like is like TikTokers, like there's this guy, I'll put his name in the show notes, but like he's a biblical scholar, but he knows Hebrew and he's very intelligent. And so when people say like, oh, well, the Bible says this, and he's like, actually, you know, like the whole thing about Sodom and Gomorrah, there's a line in there about perversion. And he's like, that's a terrible mistranslation of the Greek. Actually, that word means flesh that's like unfamiliar or something. And they were actually talking about don't fuck angels, which like, okay, I don't even know what's going on in your book, but they weren't even talking about like what people ascribe to it, right?
That's what you projected onto it.
Yeah, exactly. It's because you're trying to make the case so that you can continue to be homophobic and misogynistic and pedophilic and all this other stuff. And it's just like not in there. It wasn't in there. It's not what they meant. And if you took a second to understand that, then the world would be a better place.
Yeah.
So, do you want to get into it?
Let's get in. I think this is a good introduction too.
Okay. Now it's okay. So just peek behind the curtain, Woho. So Mac and I choose the subjects that we want to talk about, and then we work together to figure out what movies will go into those categories. And I had suggested Tenebrae because I really like it a lot, but Mac hadn't seen it. And I was expecting to cover it. And then today, Mac was like, let me do it because I have some things to say. I'm scared.
I'd be pleased as punch for you to there have been times where I see things and I have a gut reaction. And then people tell me, no, this is what the point was. And I go, okay, you know. So when I want to like things. That's what I want.
I know.
Listen, and I'm also happy to watch. It's not as if I was like, well, fuck mom for bringing this thing up. Like, I'm happy to watch anything.
By the way, I'm just sort of on this like slashers kick right now. Like a Stephen McDonald and I just did Bay of Blood. Wohos, go check that episode out. And I think I'm going to do one on Evil Dead Trap. Which I'd also like you to watch, Mac. It's a Japanese slasher. Ooh. But, so I don't know what's going on with me, but I'm just, like, really into this genre right now.
It's a great genre. And it, like, and here's what I'll say introductory thing. I was never bored a second of watching Tenebrae. It's really hard for me sometimes to just sit and watch something. I was able to do, like, I was surprised, actually, that I just sat there and watched it because it was very engaging. So I wouldn't even say I disliked it. It's more like I just have some things to bring up.
Okay, great.
Okay. Well, Tenebrae. Here's a brief plot synopsis. An American writer in Rome is stalked and harassed by a serial killer who is murdering everyone associated with his work on his latest book. Directed by Dario Argento and written by Dario Argento. It stars Anthony Franciosa, John Saxon, Daria Nicolodi, Giuliano Gemma, Carola Stagnaro, John Steiner, Veronica Lario, Mirella D'Angelo. Cinematography by Luciano Tovoli and edited by Frank. I'm so sorry. I'm kind of having a stroke right now. Edited by Franco Fraticelli. I'm a quarter Italian. How do I not know these things? It was released October 27th, 1982, and has a runtime of 101 minutes. Great runtime.
So, this is the quote that bookends the movie. When this movie opens, we see somebody wearing black gloves sitting in front of a crackling fire. And we hear this narration. The impulse had become irresistible. And the person with the black, I don't know, I find this movie very funny.
It's silly.
The person with the black gloves is like running their finger along text.
I do that when I read. Gloves and all. You know how there's like driving gloves? There's also reading gloves. A lot of people don't know.
Oh, I did not know that. Okay. The impulse had become irresistible. There was only one answer to the fury that tortured him. And so he committed his first act of murder. He had broken the most deep-rooted taboo and found not guilt, not anxiety or fear, but freedom. any humiliation which stood in his way could be swept aside by the simple act of annihilation. Murder.
That's a great quote.
And then we get, like, the goblin score that comes in right after that.
The music in this movie is unparalleled. It's so good. You could watch this just for the music. Like, it's just, and it always hits right at the right time when you're fuck yeah.
And the there aren't any, I think the only lyric is Paura, which means fear. Mm. So it's like, you just keep hearing that, like, over and over and over again.
So we start with Peter Neal, a handsome man, who is an American writer of violent horror novels. He visits Italy to promote his latest work, Tenebrae. Meanwhile, we see Elsa, a young female shoplifter, who gets hassled by the shop owner. And this is, like, a great scene. Like, she's kind of like, y'all, I've never shoplifted, but this is not how you do it. You don't make furtive glances every 5 seconds and go, you know, like, she's like the worst shoplifter ever. Though I did like this move. She's like reading Tenebrae, which I'm also like, why are you shoplifting a book? I don't know. And then she's got two copies, and then one falls into her bag. I was like, ooh, that was smooth. How did they catch her?
That was pretty slick. Yeah.
Right? Like, some guy had to have been like watching her. But yeah, the shop owner finds her and like grabs her. And she says, no, we can forget about all this. Here's my home address, and I guess you can come over and fuck me. And he's like, all right, cool. Have a nice day.
And gives her the book, puts the book in her purse. Yeah.
I'm like, you fucking fool. You think she gave you her real address, you dumb idiot? I mean, maybe she did, but unlikely. She then gets assaulted by a homeless man, but manages to get away by kicking him in the nards and slams the gate on him. Very scary. I've never been truly attacked like this, but there was a time when I was in high school going in downtown Raleigh, which, okay, a lot of people will be like, downtown Raleigh, so scary. It's really not. But this moment was scary. There was a, I don't know what sort of man, but somewhat mentally ill, I think, who just stood in front of me, like blocked my way on the street, and then just like, wouldn't move and was just leering at me. It was very creepy, but I just kind of like scurried away. So, like, you know, stuff like that. Y'all, I don't know. If you've never been a woman walking around in the world, I would not recommend it. It'd be very scary.
3 out of 10 would not recommend.
Yeah, would not recommend. she gets back to her apartment. He sneaks up on her door, but then watches as someone else murders her with a razor and then stuffs her mouth with the pages from the novel she was stealing, which was Tenebrae. The killer then takes a picture of her. I thought this was pretty freaky. This is like, you know, it's 80s effect, so the blood kind of looks a little bit fake, but it's still, you know, it's spooky. Like, knife right in the neck and then just stuff. Ooh, so poetic. So, Peter arrives in Rome and is accompanied by his literary agent, Bulmer. Love this actor. He's from Nightmare on Elm Street, right? He's Nancy's dad. He is so great.
And also Black Christmas.
Oh yeah. I love him. He's got a great face.
He sure does.
Very expressive. He shows off his nifty little bowler hat. Here's just my first thing about this movie, which is just, I feel like for a movie that seems to be, I guess, denouncing, you know, violence against women, like, when Peter walks in with his secretary, I just at first think, like, that's his wife. Because, like, he sees her later. But it's like every woman he comes into contact with, they're like throwing themselves at him in a way. Like there's always a huge hug and a kiss and whatnot. And I say this not in jest, but like that would be behavior that is like sexual harassment. No, like you can't just do that. And I feel like in this world you can. And I'm just like, I feel like it's great when men try to talk about violence against women. But in this movie, I feel like it's apparent that a man wrote this and that the vibe is less of, isn't this horrible that this happens? And more like, we are sad as men to see a woman get hurt. Isn't that a bummer? Like, but I feel like there's no love for women in this movie.
I mean, I think it's a double whammy because it's the 80s, it's the early 80s, and it's Italy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have like one of the most, like, a culture that really, that, I don't know how to say it. I've never been to Italy, but I took 2 semesters of Italian, and I've known people who have traveled in Italy, and it's better now, but, you know, the culture, at least at this time, you know, was a lot of, like, you know, definitely catcalling, if not overtly, like, touching women that you found attractive. Now, one thing that I have heard too, and Italian wohos, please get in touch, is that sometimes women, at the time, would be like, yeah, that's right, I've got it going on, you know? So I think it's definitely a different culture than American culture. But yeah, and then you have Dario Argento writing the movie too. So, I mean, I just think it's a whole combination of things. I mean,
you know, I don't know. Like, again, I know it's the 80s. I know it's a different time, different culture. But it was jarring. And also, every woman is like the youngest, most beautiful woman you've ever seen. Sometimes a little bit too young looking. We'll get into that. Yeah, women who are not sexy, they don't exist. Don't even try. I've never known one. Hey, if you aren't sexy, we put you in a box and we just don't show you. We don't see the light of day. I just hate shit like that. So he then is interviewed by a lesbian journalist. only lesbians care about misogyny. And she, it's so funny because when she greets him, yeah, again, we get the whole song and dance of him kissing and, you know, them hugging. And then she immediately is like, so you wrote this sexist novel. And the way that they write her and the way she is acting is this, like, caricature of what men think a feminist is. This is your grade A feminazi, boys. She's a lesbian. She hates men. Would she just calm down for a second? She takes things so seriously. And just my problem with this is that's how the movie wants us to think about her. Like, that's not what the... It'd be one thing, because, yeah, it's true that men in power can view women like this, of like, ugh, yeah, look at this chick. But, like, the movie wants us to think this, because the way this woman is acting is absolutely insane. She's the worst actress in this movie, I think. Like,
yeah.
I don't think you watch an Argento movie for the acting, but nobody bothered me as much as she did. I actually liked the kind of over-the-top acting, but her, I was like, this is too much. Like, I hated her. but yeah, she's like, you're writing a book. Wait, okay, also, all good criticisms, by the way. You know, you wrote a book about, you know, women getting murdered. Why are you so obsessed with this? A question I would ask. So, but yeah, no, she's a crazy bitch. He then meets his assistant. I thought they were married when I saw them. Nope, that's just how we talk to women. And then he meets Johnny, who is a very awkward young man who will be his assistant. And what I love is his manager, his agent, is like, yeah, you know, eventually he'll be working at our firm. And then Johnny gets in the car and he's like, so that's what you tell him to, you know, keep prolonging his dreams or something. And the agent just kind of gives him a look like, hey, shut up, which I thought was fun. Also, in the beginning of the movie, I forgot to mention, he's, you know, boarding a plane to get to Italy. And we see somebody, you know, mess with his bag. And now when he's arrived, somebody has broken his watch and soiled his clothes, the present he was going to give to his assistant or secretary. You know, who could have done this? Neil is unaware that he has also been followed to Rome by his embittered ex-fiancée, Jane, my favorite character. I love this actress. I love her. Favorite character. Amazing. So, the murderer sends Neil a letter informing him that his books have inspired him to go on a killing spree, and then he's contacted by the police in the form of Detective Germani, who only drinks on duty, and his partner, Inspector Altieri. Germani, second favorite character. I love this guy. Mm-hmm. I love the way this guy looks. I love his voice. I love his character. See, I don't hate this movie. Like, again, very interesting. Like, Suspiria, as good as it was, there were some times where I was like, TikTok, TikTok, I'm kind of excited for this to be over. I think I wanted more of this movie. I liked all the characters so much. And you know, Germani's kind of like, he's not super aggressive with him, you know, even though I guess everybody could say, hey, this guy kind of inspired a murderer. But he is kind of like, do you have anything you could help us with the investigation? Like, you know, you write mystery or like these kind of things, any help? And, you know, I'm reading this book, but haven't gotten to the end yet, so don't tell me who the killer is. Like, he's kind of keeping a distance, but not pushing him away. I thought it was very subtle, very good. So then Neil gets a call. It's the killer, and Neil tries to stall him on the phone. Germani and Altieri run outside, but there's no trace of the caller. And Altieri, of course, is wearing heels, because that's the only shoes women are allowed to wear. And Germani's like, if only I had a male partner, then, you know, you could have run faster. And she's like, if you had a male partner, then what would you bitch about? See, I like that. That was cute. That was cute. Yeah. And yeah, at one point, Neil's like, hey, do you want a drink? Or do you not drink on duty? And he goes, I only drink on duty. Man, love this guy. So then the scene cuts to a beautiful woman on the beach in a white dress. She's surrounded by several male admirers. This scene is like a dream. It's very weird, but I would say in a good way. Like, first she's surrounded by them, then she kind of trots away, but then does a little coquettish, like, look over the shoulder and kind of takes part of her dress down, and she's like, you know, topless. And then, you know, she's sitting on the ground surrounded by these guys, but she's kind of like, you know, it's very weird.
Yeah.
But again, in a good way. And then she kind of like, you know, is leaning back into them. And then one of them slaps her across the face. And then that, the guy who slaps her runs, and the admirers run after him and tackle him. And then the woman attacks him with red shoes and like even gets the heel like in his mouth. It's very sexual. And yet, like, no sex happens. You know, even though they're beating the shit out of this guy, it still feels very sexual. I don't know. I think this scene is really good for how weird it is. There's a lot of drifting in and out of, like, different moments. But I like that, too. The whole thing sometimes feels like a dream a little bit. So next we see Tilda and her... Tilda is the lesbian and her girlfriend, who will, you know, of course, be our next victims. Again, these two... This is bizarre. This is what a man thinks lesbians are. I've never seen a weirder pair of lesbians in a movie in my life. What the fuck kind of lesbians are these? Like, they're sitting in like a restaurant, and they obviously hate the shit out of each other. Tilda is, you know, this horrible actress is like, you know, shooting daggers into her girlfriend's eye into her girlfriend's back, and the girlfriend is flirting with a guy and is like, I'm bringing him back, you know, and then kisses Tilda, but Tilda doesn't kiss back. It's so weird. So they live in this huge stone industrial building. We then hear the great music start up, so we know some shit's about to go down. The camera dollies?
I guess this is a crane shot, you know, and it was accomplished by the camera, you know, being on this crane. I mean, it's acrobatic, this camera work for this scene. I wrote dollies because I wasn't sure what the term was, but it basically just like it glides up the building and basically follows the women around the house onto the roof. I mean, it's just really, really incredible.
Yeah, I like, there are a lot of things that are like from the perspective of the killer, very Peeping Tom-esque. Which, great movie. So I really liked that. Even though I do think the violence against women in this movie I don't like this type of violence depicted because it feels sexual in nature, but not in a way that critiques the very act of sexualizing violence. It just is. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
There is, you can make a critique about how we sexualize violence, especially against women, but then there's just depicting that with no critique. And that's what this movie does. And I really hate that. It just perpetuates violence against women. And for that to be a thing that it feels like this movie is denouncing and yet doing that makes me icky. I don't like that. That would be one of my biggest critiques about this movie. But the only way in which that works is this idea that we, the audience, are voyeurs as well. Like the camera is from the POV of the voyeur. And we also are consuming this. But again, I really don't want to give him that much credit. Like, I don't think that idea is used enough. And I don't think that the violence is denounced enough for me to give him all that credit of like, yeah, that's definitely what he was going for. Cause like, it's so male gazey, but not in a, we're dissecting the male gaze here. In my opinion.
Yeah. I agree. I don't think this is a movie that is. I mean, I think this is definitely a slasher. I don't think it's, like somebody said, it was very meta, but
no,
I don't see how it's meta. I mean, there's the novel and then there's the murders that imitate the murders in the novel, but I don't think that's what they meant. I think they meant that it's a commentary on the genre. I think it's a slasher.
Yeah.
So I don't.
Like, it's still the art.
Maybe I'm missing something, but.
If you got women running around with their tits out getting killed, that's just a slasher. Like, that's just what the slasher trope is.
Now, one movie I would like to, when we come back around to slashers again, one movie I would like to look at is called Slumber Party Massacre, ooh, which is made by women.
Okay.
And so I would like to go through that movie with you.
Yeah.
When we come around to slashers again.
We definitely need to watch more movies directed by women, for sure.
For sure.
Yeah, and then we get this, like, you know, little fight between Mary and the GF, I guess, of Tilda. I mean, again, these aren't lesbians. I guess you could say that Marion's bisexual, because, you know, she's had sex with this guy. She's the sexiest woman you've ever seen. She's like, this makes no sense. She's like draping her blanket around her kind of like a toga, but we got to make sure there's always one boob out, like always. And she's like, yes, I had sex with him and he was better than you ever were. What? And Tilda just, you know, huffs and puffs in her room. And again, like this woman, it wasn't bad acting in a good way. She's just constantly like, and it just took me out of it. So then we see gloved hands cutting the blinds outside of the window. Ooh, I love this. That's so, he just so methodically cuts each blind off. Never thought about that before. Tilda then yells at Marion to turn down the music that she's blasting, and we hear someone whisper, pervert, filthy, slimy pervert. Tilda thinks it's a great time to take off her top because why not? Not that it matters because her nips were showing through both shirts, so I don't know what the difference is. But then the killer grabs her from behind and kills her. Marion calls out for Tilda, and then we see the gloved hand of the killer cut a light bulb with the razor. Marion is then killed and becomes the image for the movie poster as the killer takes pictures of the victims. I do like, again, also taking the pictures. I think that's very much, if something is meta, I guess it's that. But again, really. It's not meta, really.
Is but it? This whole sequence is really, really amazing because as the women are fighting and as they're moving around into different rooms, the camera is just like gliding around. And then it literally does go like up on the roof, across the roof, down to the other side of the building. And then it comes around to the front. And then we see this like staircase where, you know, Marion is killed. I just want to watch that section over and over. It's just really, really amazing.
I mean, again, yeah. I think that I guess that's what bums me out about this movie, is that there are some things that are glaring to me, But then the other parts of the movie are so good. I wish maybe you could somehow take this out of that time and maybe change Argento's mind about some things, because then I think it would be perfect. But those things are a little bit too much for me to ignore.
And they're kind of like part of the time. I mean, the fact that all the women walk around with no bras on. And I mean, Daria Nicolodi is like the only character. Well, Altieri a little bit, but Nicolodi is the only character who kind of has a personality. But even she like kisses. I couldn't believe it when she started making out with what's his face. And then they're like, let's not think about this. In the morning, we'll forget about all of this. Just like, come on.
So yeah, you can continue being my employee, you know, and I don't have to do anything special.
I mean,
for
it's
you.
Fine if you want to have casual sex, but I mean, this whole thing of like, well, it's just like, I don't know, it's very weird. But I guess of the time, I mean, I'm not, you know.
And like, I'm not necessarily against, you know, it's like a lot of women go around, like, no, what woman wears a bra in her own house, you know? Like, that's pretty realistic, but I wish it was done in a way that wasn't so apparent for the male gaze, you know, like.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, this is all, I mean, yeah, this is like completely male gazey, like you said. I mean, yeah, absolutely.
So then we see someone developing the film and washing off the straight razor. They're in a very distinct basement. Well, I don't know. It seems like this basement kind of gets a little bit of light. So maybe not a good place to develop film, but the settings in this movie, every single one of them is beautiful. So good. So then the porter at Peter's hotel sends his daughter up to help Peter with his plumbing, which is not a metaphor, just so you know. Maybe this character made me the most uncomfortable, I think, because she really... I don't know how old the actress was, but she did look so young to me and yet was still like sexed up, you know, like
the character they say
is 17.
Spoiler, she's killed. But yeah, she's 17. Yeah, I don't know how old the actor was.
Yeah, but they tried to make her look young and yet still sexy. And that was at least the other women were like, women, you know, like they were like, oh, wah, 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 this is a woman, but this is a child. That's how I felt. And I was like, ugh. And, you know, she's throwing herself at this guy. Sure, Peter Neal, he's a handsome man, but every woman is just like, take me. Like, that's how it feels. And that's gross.
But also, I mean, he's like this like wildly successful novelist, like, you know, and this girl, he says to him, you know, the bookstore down the street, like, they just have your book in the front window, you know, so.
But that, I think most people would just be like, that's really interesting. They wouldn't want to fuck him, you know. I think most women would, like, the amount of women that would be like, and I need to have him are way less than men would like to think. Like, an absolutely normal woman would be like, this is so cool. I'm kind of starstruck. They wouldn't be like, you know, they all have your book. That's what they want. You know, this is what Argento hopes happens whenever he meets somebody. And they're like, oh, are you the famous film director Argento? You know, everybody's showing your movie. That's his fantasy. So then, yeah, Anne comes up and lets us know that, yes, in fact, we were supposed to think that that girl was sexy, and makes an innuendo. And then Peter literally says, oh, that's jailbait. Okay, all right. You don't have to keep hammering it into our heads. Someone then slips another letter to Peter under the door. And then we see the killer's POV as they spy on two hotel workers, which I did like the scene. The killer has to hide, and just these two dudes are working. So, you know, this guy literally is like... I guess the idea is that if they had discovered the letter sooner, maybe they could have found this guy, but it slipped under so quietly that Anne doesn't recognize or doesn't see it yet. But yeah, I did love this scene. Like, again, this movie's not very long, so you can kind of have scenes like this where it's kind of like, I don't know what purpose this serves, but it kind of fleshes out the world a little bit more.
And this is right by the elevators, I think, and this hotel just looks so grimy and so 70s. And I'm always like, oh my God, the carpet must just like reek of just like cigarette smoke and just sweat. It's like everybody was sweaty, you know, and I don't know. It's like, it's so disgusting. That's the kind of thing I think about when I see a scene like this.
So then Peter finds the letter, runs out of the building to try to find who could have left it. The letter's in Latin, and it says, "Sic transit gloria lesbi," so passes, which means "so passes the glory of Lesbos." What could that mean? And yeah, because Anne literally says, "What could that mean?" And he says, "Well, it means they know Latin." But I love it. At the coroner's office, Germani is filled in on the deaths of the lesbians. I don't know why that makes me laugh. Peter then meets a very effeminate guy who wants to interview him on TV. Yeah, okay, I picked up on that too. I was like, is this guy supposed to be gay? Like, that was my first thought, was like, is this guy supposed to be gay? But seems to have, quote, have the wrong end of the stick when it comes to Peter's book. He's not being aggressive, but kind of subtly, he's like, you know, well, Tenebrae is about perversion. And, you know, two victims in the books are deviants. And Peter says, well, you know, one of the victims is gay, but that doesn't make him a deviant. And, you know, the journalist is like, well, what is deviance? You know, I'm a Catholic and I'm pro-divorce and pro-choice. So that would make me a deviant in the eyes of Catholicism. And Peter's just kind of like, yeah, do you want to talk? I thought this was a morning show. Do you want to talk about this right now? And the journalist says, well, the killer wants to rid the world of corruption. And Peter explains exasperatedly, well, the killer's insane. But I thought this was a great, if anything's meta, it's this.
Yeah, this was great. Yeah.
Yeah, I think this was great. And it would be my critique of a lot of things. Like, okay, for instance, I've had very many infuriating conversations with men, of course, about why South Park is in fact not subversive. Some people try to say, oh, well, you know, they make fun of everybody. And I'm like, yeah, some people don't need to be made fun of, you know, like, and I had just an argument with this guy that was then saying like, well, you know, some of these things are to point out that they're bad. And I'm like, no, even if the characters are bad, we're still depicting this horrible thing and people are still laughing at it. So no, this isn't subversive, you know, like, Mr. Garrison becoming Mrs. Garrison, and then that being what you think a trans woman is not subversive, even if we're supposed to think, oh, that's not good that people don't like. I'm going to say him because there's no way that that's a trans woman. And I would say this is a great argument, kind of like,
yeah,
where some authors or creators might think, well, you know, the point is supposed to be that this is a bad thing. And to that, I say, I don't think you made a good enough point that it's a bad thing. You know, like, if there's confusion, you didn't make it apparent that it's a bad thing. And that is honestly the critique I have about this movie. So I do like that that's in there. It does make you think. But yeah, I thought that was a great point.
Okay. I looked it up. They keep using the word aberrant, you know, aberrant. And I was like, it's aberrant, you fuckers. Well, the European pronunciation is aberrant. The American pronunciation is aberrant. But I just, like, it was just grating on my ears. Like, aberrant? What the fuck? That's not a word.
How about abhorrent?
Oh, abhorrent is a word.
Oh, okay. Germani and Altieri arrive during the studio interview, but Bulmer very wisely is like, how about we talk outside? You know, he's in the middle of an interview. He'll be done soon. Good point. I think it would be pretty bad press if they tell you about two more murders that happened because of your book. So later, Germani says that although he has read all the classic mystery stories, he could never guess who the killer was, despite being a detective. Mm-hmm. As our crew drives off, Altieri tells Germani that she got...
Oh, yeah. Yves Montand.
Eve Montand. Yeah, that's like all she can talk about. It's like she just like will just say, like, "Oh, that's Eve Montand," and then just later she's like, "I got it." He's like, "Got what?" "I got his autograph." they were really cute.
Then I went down this little rabbit hole, and I found out that Eve was married to Simone Signore, who was in the original Diabolique.
Wow.
It's all connected on the world board.
It's all connected.
And by the way, if you want to see some cuteness, look up Eve Montand and Simone Signore. They were cute as fuck.
Oh, I love
in photographs. Incredible. Yeah.
Peter's bemoaning writing his book and looks out the window and thinks he sees his ex, Jane. Anne thinks that it was Jane who messed up Peter's bag, but Peter's still unconvinced. The killer, still wearing gloves, seems to have a Philodex with documents and pictures.
I thought this was really funny, too. Like, why do you need a file? It's like alphabetized.
Hey, he might be a killer, but he's got standards when it comes to organization. That's actually a thing a killer would do, you know?
Well, no, but then there are all these photographs just like lying around on the floor. So
he hasn't got it's you know, maybe it's wishful thinking. Maybe if I get the file decks, you know, Philodex, I will do it. We've all done that. Maybe if I get the fancy vacuum cleaner, I'll clean. No, you won't. We then see a gloved person get out of a car and stalk a sex worker, but then realizes they've left their key. Luckiest day of that sex worker's life.
Yeah. Honestly.
And again, I don't know, I just was struck with the thought of just like, man, I really wish they would legalize or get some protection for sex workers. Like, this is why you need to prevent shit like this. So then the plumber girl, Maria, got on the bike of her boyfriend, and they have a little tiff, and he just fucking leaves her in the middle of the night on an abandoned street. This scene was so scary, and not yes. because of the killer. This is maybe one of my biggest
fears. This is the scariest. Me too. This one, bar none, is the scariest scene in the movie. And I've seen this movie, I don't know, 4 times or something, and it's scary every time.
Yeah, it's terrifying. She, you know, she's walking around, it's the middle of the night, and there's a dog behind a fence who's just, like, barking at her. And she kind of is like, you know, hey, get the fuck away from me. And this dog, Doberman, is very athletic and fucking jumps that huge fence. This is a great dog actor, by the way. Yeah. A little bit too good, maybe.
Actually, there's one part, we'll get to it, but there's one part where the dog's just like smiling and just like huffing it. And it reminded me of Black Sunday. Remember those dogs that they're like really scary, but then in one shot, they're just like get their tongues yeah. out and everything. It's like, they're just cute little puppies.
Yeah, they're sweet. I bet you could, this dog loves to get his belly rubbed.
Oh, for sure.
Well, the dog jumps the fence and she gets chased, and it is just horrible. She runs, she's screaming, and gets attacked by the dog. And it's just so scary because running away from a dog is a losing battle. Like, it will catch up to you. They are faster than you. And that is so scary. It's attacking her, but she manages to get away. And I think, when it comes to like effects, they did such a good job with the blood on her. Like it wasn't like gratuitous, but it did look like she had been through something, you know. She manages to fight it off and scales a fence. She's very athletic and runs away. Well, that dog also scales the fence and catches up to her. Since the killer left the key in the door, she reaches his house, you know, not knowing that it's a killer's house. She's like, you know, banging on the door like, "Please, please, anybody." And she's able to escape into the house and close the door. While she's down there, she finds all the photos and the documents that the killer left laying about. and I did like this little detail. She's got this skirt, which very cute. It's like one of those jean skirts that buttons like in the front. And with, you know, the big pockets on the side, and she just starts stuffing all that shit into her pocket. I was like, I've never seen that in a movie before, of like a character completely unrelated to an investigation being like, I need to get this to somebody, you know?
Yeah.
I really liked that.
Me too.
So she's looking at this and she's stuffing it in her pockets. And then we get a high angle shot of the girl quietly trying to find a way out of the house without getting killed or eaten. I mean, because now you got a rabid dog outside. You know you're in the house of a murderer. What do you do? She finds a phone and, you know, tries. It's so sad. She smiles, like, oh, I'm saved, and begins to call. But then she sees someone who thinks, you know, might help her. But then the voice whispers, spy, and chases her back outside. As she's running, I mean, this was fucking dumb. She's like throwing the photo, I guess, in an attempt to get him to go away. I'm like, why? But I guess if you were freaking out, you'd do anything. She tries to climb one more fence, but falls and gets chopped up by the killer with an axe. Bummer.
Yeah. Hi, Maria.
We then see somebody mowing up the lawn, the killer did not pick up the photos. You know, seeing, like, we just see it from, like, kind of the point of view of the lawnmower, almost. And it's, like, kind of passing a bit of the scattered documents, and then just lands on, like, her, like, a shot of, like, the end of her legs, and they're all bloody. Oh, I thought that was such a good shot.
That was great.
With the dread of knowing what's about to come, and then you see her. But you don't see all of her. You know, you just see the leg, all you need. Very good. So, Germani reads a note from the killer, and the letter says that the perverts will be eliminated, and also Neil will be killed. Neil, Gianni, and Anne are trying to figure things out, and Neil remembers his conversation with Bertie, the TV guy, and how fucking weird he was before the interview, and he said something very similar to what the letter had said. So they look up his address, Neil and Gianni go to check it out. Now, this is where I first get suspicious, all right? Because I'm like, why won't they call the police? You know? Seems very weird to me that Neil's like, let's not get the police involved. I was like, that's it. That doesn't just seem like characters being dumb. It seems a little bit calculated. Okay. So Anne learns the news of Maria's death on TV and the fact that the killer has threatened to kill the great corruptor. He says, and you know, so several businessmen and politicians are now expected to leave the city. She just turns off the TV. That was so funny. My favorite journalist ever. That was so funny.
So good.
Oh my god, I love that. So Anne goes to her car. By the way, this whole time I was scared for Anne. Like, this whole movie. They did a good job of this. Like, anytime she was near a car, I was like, is he in the back of the car? And she sees a woman across the street from her. She calls out to her, thinking she's Jane. After Anne leaves the apartment, the score strikes up again. So I'm like, oh god, she's a goner. Johnny scales a fence along with Peter Neal, and they crouch outside of Birdie's house behind a plant. And whose house should it be? But I love this. It's like the movie doesn't say it out loud, but it's the same house that Maria was in. So just we, the audience, just know, oh, it's this guy. And God, I loved that. So they're hiding. Inside, the killer is burning various pictures and documents. I guess he's finally like, I better throw this shit away. Johnny and Neil see the silhouette of Birdie, who looks out his own glass door. Johnny leaves Neil. You know, he's like, I'm going to go around this way. And Neil's like, cool, I'll chill here. And then sees the lights go out in Birdie's house. Then we see somebody, or Gianni, we see Birdie turn around and he goes, yes, it was me, I killed them. And then he is killed by an axe. But we don't see who the killer is, just see an axe break through the glass door. Johnny is freaked out and then comes upon Peter, who was struck on the head with a rock. Interesting. But for some reason, Johnny can't provide any info about the killer. So now we've got something kind of weird going on here. So it was Birdie who killed the women before. Right. I guess in some act of like, see, this does corrupt people, which is like a, I can see somebody, and actually I had this thought, like, I didn't necessarily think it was him, but actually at first I thought it was somebody on the police force. Like, I figured this must be somebody we've seen before who's like making a critique about Peter Neal. But I didn't guess it was Birdie. And so, but now we've got a new killer in the mix. Okay. So Anne and Peter make out. Yeah, they have a sexy moment, because why not? And make a deal with each other to forget all about this in the morning. All right.
No.
The next morning, we see the girl from the beach scene, the beach dream sequence earlier, on the beach, stabbed. Peter tells his agent he's thinking of leaving Rome for Paris. Bulmer wants him to stay, because they're about to get a $1 million deal, and Peter says he'll think about it. Right after Peter leaves the office, we discover that Bulmer is having an affair with Jane! Wow. Okay, even though we haven't seen Jane, we've kind of just heard of her, I think this actress does such a good job that, like, even though we've only heard snippets about her, you know exactly who she is. She is a crazy bitch, and I love her. Like,
she's so gorgeous. We saw her at the airport in the very first scene.
Yes.
But we didn't know who she was or anything. But yeah.
I love her lips. Like, she just has this way of, like, she looks crazy. I mean this, like, affectionately. She looks insane, but she's so pretty. I was, like, drawn to her every time she was on screen. I don't know, just the way this woman acted, you can tell, oh, she's a crazy ex, for sure. I loved her. But yeah, Bulmer and Jane are, you know, like, does he know? No, he doesn't know. It's very intense. Johnny is still traumatized, duh, by witnessing the murder. I actually thought this was, like, a pretty good depiction of somebody who's traumatized, because it's all he can think about. And while driving, he keeps getting flashes of it and causes a car crash. And yeah, that's what trauma does to you. Peter's like, I'll walk, you drive, and gets out of the car and meets Germani inside of Birdie's house. And Peter still has yet to mention that he was there that evening. Very interesting, because you'd think, kind of witnessing the murder, they'd want to give some help to the police, but they don't. This is where I begin to think, They find extensive files that Birdie kept on Peter. Like, extensive. Like, everything, you know, he's Catholic. I thought this was an interesting detail. Devout Catholic.
Right.
Okay. And, you know, grew up on Rhode Island, all this stuff. Germani again asks for Neil's help with the case, and Neil quotes Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and says that the mystery behind the case is most certainly weird, and that the elimination,
hard to believe, must be the truth.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that's what he wrote.
yeah, right? Direct quote there. When Jane arrives home, she finds a package addressed to her on her doorstep, and inside the box are some red heels. Interesting. Bulmer is waiting for Jane at the piazza. I love this little moment of just Bulmer. Hey, we've all been there. We're waiting for someone and we kind of don't know what to do with ourselves in public. So he's just kind of people watching. And I love this. Like, it doesn't make the movie feel bloated. It just gives you more detail. It, like, really, I think it removes the tension almost, so that you get surprised when we see, that there is a POV of somebody walking. looking at people's feet, going into the bar, and then back to Bulmer. Bulmer watches a couple fight across the way, two men fighting, a lot of fighting going on in Italy, apparently. The man and the couple storms off, leaving the woman in tears. There's some punks outside. A child hides under his bench and then is taken away by his guardian. And then someone draws a knife on Bulmer and stabs him. And then he loses his hat. So sad. We then see just the shot of some feet of somebody who we think is Jane wearing the red heels coming upon Bulmer's dead body. Yeah, and I just feel like the shot of him getting killed is so surprising because we've had this little lull of people watching. But the thing about the people watching is it's fun. You're not bored. Like, you're genuinely kind of with Bulmer, kind of like, you know, you're in this strange area like he is, you know, an American in Italy, just kind of witnessing things around him. I love it. It's so good. So Anne has made arrangements for Peter to go to Paris, which I don't know, like, yeah, obviously you have to leave, dumbass. Johnny comes by and says that he wants to go to Bertie's house to see if they can find any clues, because he just can't. He knows if he goes back, he'll be able to recall, because he's missing something. Mm-hmm. So Johnny scales a fence. He leaves his key in the ignition, and we see some black gloves take it out. Johnny reflects back on Bertie's murder and sees in his mind's eye Bertie say, "I killed them. I killed them all." He goes back to his car and then is strangled by someone in his back seat. Dun, dun, dun. Then from the POV of the killer, we see an axe hidden in some foliage. The killer takes it. Jane is sitting at home and calls Anne and mysteriously confesses to doing something and not wanting to kill herself. She says, "You need to come by. I'm afraid I'll kill myself." She asks for Anne's help. And Anne, being the bro that she is, says, "Okay, I'll be right round." I mean, women helping women. We love to see it. And again, I love Jane. She's just sitting in this house, like, scared out of her mind. She's pacing the floor, holding a gun as a storm rages outside. Meanwhile, Altieri speaks to Bulmer's housekeeper. Mm-hmm. In Spanish. Very, very, very cool. Altieri's trilingual. There's some banging on the door at Jane's house. Anne drives over, but the killer smashes through the window at Jane's and chops off her arm. This was so scary. So good. There's so much blood. Like, she's lifting her, like, arm up, and blood is just arcing across. And then the killer chops her up. God, this scene's good. The arm effect is so good.
But the blood arc, right? Just like inside.
So good.
So good. But there's just a flashback.
Okay. Yeah. There's a flashback of, we see from the POV of a killer, somebody killing that woman on the beach. Very similar to the way we see Bulmer get killed. So it must have been the same person. And so Jane is wearing the shoes of this dead woman.
Right.
So Anne, we think, gets to the house, and immediately as she enters, a killer chops her shoulder. Who should the killer be? Peter Neal, of course. Listen, I don't think it's a bad thing that I guessed it. You know, I think it's pretty, maybe it's pretty apparent, but I don't think it takes anything out of it. You know, I think a good mystery is something that you can guess.
And I can't remember where it is, but there's at one point Germani says that he's finished Tenebrae. And guess what? He realized who the killer was on page 30. So I don't think it is a bad thing that you guessed the killer.
Yeah. And I was just about to say, I love that part too, because it I feel like in that moment you know that it doesn't take away from the story. Like, you can anticipate something and enjoy the little nuggets they're giving you, you know? Because it doesn't even try to twist and turn you either. It just gives you whatever information you need and you can decide. And I think that's a good mystery. Peter Neal comes out of his fugue state and is sad that he killed Anne. But then it's revealed it's not Anne. It's Altieri, because Germani and Anne come through the door. So sad. Jermani is Johnny.
Jermani is Johnny/Johnny on the spot because the housekeeper knew that Bulmer was sleeping with Jane. So Neil confesses that he killed Birdie, but not the other women, because he wanted the razor killer to be blamed for Bulmer and Jane's murders.
Okay. So then Peter turns around and slices his neck in front of Anne and Jermani. Jermani is, I guess, a really bad cop because he does not double tap. Which, again, this was the part that I was kind of like, all right, he's going to come back. He's not really dead. Jermani and Anne call into the police station and they go back to the car. Jermani tells Anne he couldn't believe it was Neil either, but then he got a telex from Interpol. When Neil was a teenager on Rhode Island, a girl was brutally murdered. He couldn't be tied to the murder, but Jermani says that if Neil did that, it was an act that haunted Peter his whole life. In fact, it was in his book, and Jermani recites the opening paragraph yet again. He inexplicably goes back into the house, leaving Anne alone, and finds, of course, that Peter's body is missing. He kneels down to pick up an embroidered handkerchief, and he looks at, like, the knife, and there are these little, like, blood, you know, like... he somehow cut himself and there are these blood packets attached to it. And that's how the blood came out, you know? I feel like this was a look inside the curtain that, like, do they use this in movies?
I guess so. I don't know.
So then of course, Jermani, I get like, he's been such a good cop up to this point. This part made me a little bit mad because now he's got his back turned where there's obviously a killer in the house with him. Peter is, of course, standing behind him and, you know, kills him. Then Anne tries to get into the house, but during this kerfuffle, a fucking weird metal sculpture is blocking the door. When she finally gets the door to open, a piece of the sculpture impales Peter and he is killed. And I do love this ending scene because Anne, of course, even though she's obviously like, damn, this guy killed someone, she's like, still, this is still someone she loves, and the screaming is so good, and he just keeps looking down, but he can't get off of the thing because it's like impaled him into the wall behind him, and it's just disturbing. It's so gross. Great, great ending. And then we fade to black. At least Anne lived.
And the credits roll, and she's still screaming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very creepy. But this whole movie, I thought Anne was going to die. I'm so glad she survived.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. And kind of funny, I didn't plan it this carefully. I just thought these are two fun slashers. But there's a connection here between the endings of both movies. Sort of with a booby trap, if you will.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's true. That's true.
It's kind of fun.
Well, what phobia is that? Cynophobia is the overwhelming fear of dogs. I feel like it's fine to have a healthy fear of dogs. They're very cute, but they can kill you. Like, I know cats can hurt you pretty bad, but just not on the same level as a dog, you know?
No.
I think I have a healthy fear of dogs.
Me too. You shouldn't go up to strange dogs.
No. And I am not somebody who believes that inherently there are some dog breeds that are evil either. I feel like that, I can't believe people still think that, you know? I talk to people all the time who are like, yeah, you know, pit bulls. And it's like, no, it's not pit bulls. It's people who own the pit bull. Like, a golden retriever could do that too if you abused it. So that's my opinion.
I know. One time when I worked at the school, anyway, there was a guy who came to, like, deliver something to the school, and he drove a semi-truck, and in his passenger seat, he had a mini pincher, and that dog was so well-trained and so friendly and so sweet. I was like, if I ever have a dog, that's the kind of dog I want to have. Super sweet. But what I thought was kind of interesting was he was inspired by having an obsessed fan himself. Oh. Criticize him for the damaging psychological effects of his previous work. And the phone calls culminated in death threats toward Argento, who channeled the experience into the writing of Tenebrae.
Interesting.
And he also wanted to explore the senselessness of killings he had seen and heard about while staying in Los Angeles in 1980. And his feeling at the time that true horror came from those who wanted, quote, to kill for nothing.
That's interesting, though, because I feel like everybody killed for a reason in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Like, every murder is senseless, obviously, but, like, they did have... Like, I would agree that, like, senseless killing is scary, but I feel like a movie like The Purge maybe does that a little bit better, because there's, like... This is one of my biggest, scariest ideas to me, but, like, there's a killer in one of the Purge movies that goes into this block party and just starts stabbing people, you know?
Right,
that's
right.
That, to me, is how you depict something like that. No... Not trying to detract. I'm not a detractor of. Well, I've already stated the things my critiques of this movie, but I don't think that that's a problem with this movie. But I feel like that is a true depiction of people who kill for nothing. Is just actually killing just for no damn good reason.
Yeah, and there was a like the end of a Law and Order or something one time when they caught these two teenagers who had like. You know, performed a murder, and they asked them why they did it, and they said, "I just wanted to know what it felt like." That to me is like super scary.
Yeah, not okay. Not to bring up, I do this now with everything. Not to bring up One Piece, but okay, there was one thing that I thought. I mean, there's multiple things I like, but there's a part of one of the arcs that is so good. There's a whole plot in One Piece where there are these fishmen, and they are completely subjugated and like. Like literally violence is, they are victims of violence and like slavery in this world because they're seen as like not equal to humans. And there's a whole Fishman Island. And one of the queen, like there was a queen of Fishman Island who desperately wanted humans and fishmen to be together because at this point, fishmen were only safest in Fishman Island, but didn't get to enjoy anything in the, you know, above world. And so she desperately wanted, even though there were so many acts of violence against fishmen perpetrated by humans, she wanted the children and the adults of Fishman Island to believe that they could live in harmony. But there was a group of super radicalized fishmen who were completely like hateful of humans. And a few of them came out of that were like, that they stated were her worst fear. And they were people, they were fishmen that hated humans, even though no human had ever done anything to them. And when somebody asked, and they even would hurt other fishmen for, you know, the sake of trying to hurt all humans. Like one of them killed her because she was so vocal about humans and fishmen coming together. And when they asked, when one of them asked him why he was doing this, he was like, because I want to, you know, nobody ever did anything to me. I just want to. I just thought that was so smart of like, that is scary. Like, if you have so much hate in a world, that's what you breed, you know, is people who do it not even because somebody did something to them, but just because they have all this hatred in their heart.
Yes.
The impressive 2.5 minute crane shot that encircles Tilda's house took 3 days to be completed. Stupid American distributors wanted the shot to be cut from the film for U.S. release, but Argento refused. Idiots. I'm glad Argento stood his ground. The original film's poster shows an image of a woman with her throat cut. The U.K. release in 1983 censored the violent image by placing a red bow around the neck after posters displayed on the London Tube drew complaints. Okay, now that's fair. I think if I was on the Tube, and I had my little baby with me, and they saw a woman getting her throat cut, I'd be like, hey, I don't think I want to look at this. Some later UK releases on video and DVD editions used the censored image. The most recent, including Arrow's DVD/Blu-ray release, have reinstated the original poster image for all their covers. I think it's a fine cover, but yeah, maybe don't put it in like a super public area like that. The word Tenebrae is a Latin/Italian term meaning darkness or shadows. I think it's a great name for the movie. Dario Argento called Anthony Franciosa, Peter Neal, one of the most difficult actors he's ever worked with. What? I need to know more.
I know.
Oh, this is the girl with the red shoes in the flashback was played by a trans woman. That's so interesting. Very cool. Mm-hmm. The background music theme playing in the department store at the beginning of the film is taken from the soundtrack of the European version of George Romero's Dawn of the Dead from 1978, which was edited and rescored under Dario Argento's supervision. That's interesting. Little Easter egg.
You can skip the rest. There's like a quote by, there's something about Quentin Tarantino as the last piece.
Well, I hate him. So.
Okay, so you want to just go to Letterboxd?
Yes. Well, what does Letterboxd have to say about it? The Cinema Corner gave it 5 stars and said, Suspiria is rightly a classic, but I prefer this by quite a lot. Perfectly shot and uses a relatively simple narrative for alarmingly psychological fear. Incredible. I would agree. Pachuses gave it 5 stars and said, all horror movies should be allowed to be this funky and colorful. I agree. Down with monochromatic, boring horror movies that are so dark you can't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
Palmat 74 gave it 5 stars. For my money, this is Argento's finest hour. Plot, direction, set design, acting, and music score come together beautifully, making this a perfect giallo. I also like the fact that there is a more modern aesthetic to Tenebrae than Argento's other giallos. There is something icy and detached about the architecture and set details that I love. And the ending is batshit crazy, which also is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Fizzy DNLP gave it 5 stars. John Saxon is so cute in this with his little hat. Tenebrae is my choice for the greatest giallo ever made. That Doberman is really tenacious. Tenacious D. And I don't know how any of that was filmed without the actress getting hurt. I also was wondering. There's also a scene where she drives away with her boyfriend on a motorcycle that would no way be filmed today without a stunt double. Very true. Goblin score is epic. Just a perfect genre film.
Okay, I just want to back up to the name of this person. I'm pretty sure this is Fuzzy Dunlap, which is a Wire reference.
A fellow man of taste. Amber Duntley gave it 5 stars. J-Sack's killing it with the hat work. Sergey Hart Rainbow Heart Sparkle gave it 5 stars. I want my death to be as theatrical as the deaths in Dario Argento's films. That's really nice. I don't.
I want my death to be super, super boring.
Let it be as chill as possible, please.
Yeah.
Aoife Walsh 208 gave it 5 stars. Round of applause for that dog.
Mm-hmm.
Our Bold Hero gave it 1 star. 40 minutes. I think I hate this movie. The dubbing is less abrasive than in Suspiria, but this is aggressively wasting my time. And if it weren't made by Italians, it'd be racist against Italians. Every time I watch a giallo classic, I'm increasingly convinced that they are not for me. Well, okay, but it is made by Italians, so I mean, it's their view of what the culture is, I guess, for better or for worse. I mean, I think that in itself is a statement that an Italian person would think this is a depiction of Italy, right?
I think so.
I mean, he's not the only Italian in the world, but you know, Sour Straw gave it 1 star. Shit movie. Fuck you, Dario. The Anjou gave it 1 star. Oh, fuck off. Billy Four gave it 1 star. I might be missing the hidden brilliance of this movie or something, but right now I'm leaning more towards y'all being brain dead sheep because this movie is actual fucking trash. Tell us how you really feel. Well, let's rate it in crumpled up pieces of Tenebrae. I'll give it 4 balls.
All right, I'll give it 4.5.
Okay. I really only am taking off what I see are the kind of outdated things. But even, I feel like even if something is of the time, it should still be critiqued. So truly is the only thing I don't like about this movie. What have we learned?
Go with your gut. I mean, if you suspect somebody as being a killer or suspicious in any way, you might be right. And so I don't think you should ignore those instincts.
Yeah.
And I feel like Germani liked Neil, you know, too much. And I think it clouded his viewpoint. And unfortunately, it got Altieri killed
and
got
him.
Himself killed. Yeah.
Would we watch it again? Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely. Favorite scene / kill? This is a hard one. I mean,
I love the crane bit, obviously, but that blood spray at the end is so, oh my God, it's so gorgeous. I really love it.
Me too. I would say that chase scene with the Doberman was pretty good.
Yeah.
I really like that scene with Balmer on waiting for Jane. I don't know. I liked almost everything in this movie. I think it was pretty beautiful. Obviously, who wins the You Fool Award? Who wins the You Fool Award? Germani. Come on,
Germani.
Run out of there as soon as you see that he's not there. Run!
Don't get that. I don't know why he goes back to the house anyway.
Yeah.
They've already called into the station.
Yeah. And like, even if he runs away, he'll catch him with backup.
Right.
Dumb. That's, and maybe I took off half a star for the gratuitous male gaze stuff and then another half for that. Cause I felt that was a little, it didn't make sense to me.
Right. Yeah. I agree.
Okay. No, you're next.
Alright, this is the brief plot summary from IMDb. When the Davison family comes under attack during their wedding anniversary getaway, the gang of mysterious killers soon learns that one of the victims harbors a secret talent for fighting back. This was directed by Adam Wingard and written by Simon Barrett. It stars Sharni Vincent, Nicholas Tucci, RIP, died in 2020.
Oh no, that's so sad. Is he a relative played... of Stanley Tucci?
No, but he played Felix. Wendy Glenn, A.J. Bowen, Joe Swanberg, Barbara Crampton, and Rob Moran. The cinematography was by Andrew Draws Palermo, and it was also edited by Wingard. The release date was September 10th, 2011 at TIFF and August 23rd, 2013. In the U.S. It has a running time of 94 minutes. Okay, this opening segment is a little odd, but okay. We get an opening segment with the neighbors, Eric and Talia. They have sex. Talia is like, not.
I was like, what's the point of her not moving to him? You know what I mean? Don't,
it's a weird detail. Anyway, he goes into the shower. She goes downstairs and I thought this was scary that the motion detector light went on outside, but she ignores it. The wind chimes are also agitated. When Eric comes out of the shower, he finds Talia's body. And then he also finds that "You're next" is written in blood on the window.
These people are so fast with this. They have great penmanship. And they write that shit so fast. And then they hide. That was the one thing I was like, it's very cool. But how does that make sense? Because painting with blood can't be easy.
No, I can't imagine that it's easy. No.
And like, he didn't hear anything. I mean, the music was playing.
That's true. The music was playing pretty loud.
I mean, okay, horror movie. So obviously that's
horror awesome. Movie logic. Yeah. Yeah. So our main cast involves mom and dad, Aubrey and Rob. They arrive at this old house. the door is open. That's weird.
No, not going to think about that.
So they just go inside. Dad concludes a worker must have left it open.
Yeah, sure.
Aaron and Crispin are driving, and we learn that Crispin's dad retired from KPG last year, which is a defense contractor, and also that mom is on medication. especially old women, older women. And she was, Crampton was 52, I think, when she made this movie, and she looks about 36. Good for her.
Right? I looked and I was like, I know that's Crampton, but isn't she older?
She's 64 now. I looked her up because I was just like, she looks way too young.
Right?
And she is. I mean, if Crispin is like 35, or are they much younger? I don't know.
Crispin's got gray in his hair. I mean, I know people can have gray hair, but I mean, like, I figured he was in his 30s at least.
Right. I mean, I had a kid at 20, but I mean, so I guess she could be.
She's had like
her real age, but yeah. She's had three boys and a girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's had four kids. Anyway. Mom hears sounds upstairs and smartly wants to get out of the house. She's like, I'm out. Let's go. But Dad doesn't believe her. Mom's like, all right, well, I'm going to wait outside because this is insane. Dad goes upstairs and he's jump scared by Crispin. You scared the shit out of me. Crispin says, yeah. And they sort of share a laugh. When they go downstairs, a closet door creaks open. Crispin and Aaron settle in. The rest of the Sibs are coming tomorrow, and Crispin seems lukewarm about it. He just sort of mysteriously says, it should be interesting. And she says, how so? And he says, you'll see. Aubrey's up in the middle of the night to take some meds. Someone in a mask looks in on her from outside. The mask is reflected in the window. Very cool shot.
I like that.
Next morning, Aaron is telling Drake and Kelly about kangaroos. Because she's Australian. Yeah. There's a little tension between Crispin and Drake.
A little.
There's quite a bit of tension between Crispin and Drake.
Okay. I'm not completely against when slasher movies make us kind of hate the characters because, you know, you don't want to be depressed by having a bunch of people you like dying. But man, they really were trying to make us hate some of these people because, like, Drake is just so next level an asshole. Like, in every moment of this movie, he is mean. But, okay, actually only to his family, though. I feel like to Aaron, he's actually not that mean.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah. Anytime he can make some kind of comment in any state he's in, he'll do it.
Especially to Crispin.
Yeah.
But also, he does pick on Felix a little, too. But especially to Crispin. There's, like, some kind of weird bad blood between them. I love the family photograph. I really do. I paused it. I mean... We've got the mom and the dad sitting on a couch in the front of the picture, and then we have the Sibs in the back behind them. Now, Amy looks like she's sincerely happy to be having her photograph taken. And mom, Aubrey, is sort of like this pasted-on mom smile. And Paul just sort of has this kind of like weak smile. Then the boys in the back are just like completely severe and like...
Yeah.
Not happy at all.
I'm so glad I'm not in a family like this.
Me too. Aaron goes to ask Aubrey if she can help, and Aubrey says, no, well, actually, could you go to the neighbors to get some milk for me? And so Aaron's like, sure. And she takes a picture of Paul, Drake, and Crispin and heads out. There's some more tension here between Drake and Crispin. Can't remember why. But I know that Drake is like admiring his dad's grilling skills. He's like, Dad, that looks so good. And Crispin is like, oh my God.
Drake's like a total kiss ass.
Yeah. And Crispin reveals to his dad that he didn't get the fellowship.
Oh, and then this is like, you know, he's like, yeah, you know, it's because I haven't published anything. And his dad's like, well, you know, people get that fellowship who haven't published anything. Thanks, Dad.
Yeah. Sucks. Drake, quote, checks on Kelly. And I don't know if this is a nod back to the Ty West short in VHS. Oh, yeah. But he's trying to get Kelly to take her bra off. But she's like, I'm just not feeling it. So he's not happy about it, but he lets it go. Aaron gets to Eric's house, the neighbor's house, and Eric, quote unquote, is sitting up on the couch. And she hears music coming from the house, but he doesn't answer. Now, I had a question about this. So anyone who knows, I would really love to know the answer. But if this guy's been dead for, say, how long has he been dead? At least a day, right?
Yeah.
Would he really be sitting up?
Yeah, like, I feel like you'd need some scaffolding to, like, keep him up like that, because he's perfectly upright.
Yeah.
Like, no head lolling, none of that.
So, but that's just a little quibble. Felix and Z and Amy and Tariq arrive. Amy is very excited to meet everyone. And Z is pretty unfriendly.
Yeah, she is kind of, nobody comments on it really, but she's definitely, like, Aaron trying her best, you know, being so sweet. Like, Kelly says something really bitchy to Drake at one point. She's like, I bet she's annoying. You know, the accent is just so jarring to me. Like, that's like never been my thought when I've met somebody with an accent. You know, I've always been like, that's really cool. Like, wow, somebody, yeah. She's talking to you about kangaroos. How are you not enjoying this? Also, she's the nicest person. And then Tariq is like, you know, pretty chill, you know, but then there's Z and she's like, like she's glaring the whole time.
So we know Drake, Crispin, and Amy from Sacrament.
Oh, that's where I've seen it. I kept wondering, like, where have I seen this woman? The Sacrament. Yes. Oh. Okay, it's all coming together now.
And Tariq is Ty West.
What? I didn't know he looked like that. That's crazy. Oh, because he's a filmmaker.
Right. So the next scene, Tariq is explaining that he's a documentary filmmaker. And Drake says he thinks that ads are the height of the art form.
I do love how Kelly is as bitchy as him. Like, she's like, yeah, that I watch TV just for the ads these days. What are you talking? And, you know, I mean, they're just trying to be assholes, but, like, God, they're the worst.
Yeah, and then Amy's like, well, he's a documentary filmmaker. And Drake's like, well, I've seen documentary commercials. What? Like, I don't, like, what is he talking about? And then he asks Aaron if she was a student of Crispin's. And she's like, yeah, I was. I mean, I'm not anymore. You know, and he's like, yeah, she was my TA. And Drake's like, pretty unprofessional. And Crispin's like, what do you want to say? Are you trying to say something? And he's like, no, I'm not saying anything. And they get into this huge fight.
You. And he's like, well, I didn't say anything. And he's like, well, I mean, you said, God. Ooh, yeah. I thought this was a great depiction of, like, families fighting, you know?
Yeah, me too. Just, like,
ugh, a little awkward.
This scene always makes me laugh because it's just so uncomfortable. If people are, I don't know, they're probably going to get this wrong, but there was a playwright who used to explore this a lot of adults turning into children, like, during, like, you know, dinner parties or stuff like this.
I
can't remember the name of this.
I rarely eat meals with, like, you know, ceramic plates and, like, clinking silverware, but I feel like movies have given me such a thing now that, like, whenever I hear the clinking of silverware in a movie, I'm just like, oh, something bad's about to happen. Something awkward. There's always just every movie, awkward dinner party, you just hear the clinking while they're eating and just nobody saying anything.
Yeah. Tariq sees something outside the window and he gets up from the table and he's shot through the forehead with an arrow. Nobody kind of notices it for a minute, and then he silently turns toward the table and falls over dead.
I love this because Crispin and Drake are still fighting, but then Drake and Kelly, like, notice it, and you just see their faces, like, so confused. Oh, I thought that was so good. This is such a great death to kick it off.
So chaos, absolute chaos ensues. People are screaming, you know, and I think it's Amy, it might be Kelly, is screaming, "We're all gonna die!" <You know>? But of course, Amy's just beside herself. I mean, this is her boyfriend, and she's extremely upset. So Aaron springs into action, though. Drake goes to get his mother out of the way of the window, and he gets shot in the shoulder by another arrow. Aaron shows everyone how to move from the dining room into the other room. There's a lot of handheld action in this movie, but this scene particular, there's a lot of handheld stuff. But this is such a great technique. She just tells everybody to put a chair in front of their face and to crouch down low and then just move into the other room. And that works for everyone. Erin's the last one. She grabs a poker and then an arrow is shot into her chair, which she drops right away and dives into the other room like a boss.
She's the best.
Felix suggests that someone make a run for the car. And Aaron's like, "No, I think everybody should remain inside the house." And then they have a fight about who's the fastest runner.
It's so funny. Kristen's like, "I can do it. I can run." And Drake, with the arrow in his bag, he's like, "No, you're a fat ass." He's like, "I'm not fat anymore." This
is so great. And Amy's like,
"I can run fast. None of you ever recognize my accomplishments." Not the time.
But she volunteers to run, and she takes off her earrings. I love that little detail. And she takes off at full speed, although this is shot in slow motion. And she's caught by a piano wire, or some kind of wire, across the neck, and she falls to the ground. And it's a very nice shot of her, like the slit in her throat and all this blood pouring out. And everyone, of course, is freaking out. Not the least is Mom, Aubrey, but Aaron remains calm and closes the doors.
The stuff with Aubrey made me so sad. Like, she's just like, my baby, like,
oh. I know. So
sad. I mean, that's the one thing about this movie is just if you think, like, if this happened, like, I don't know, it would just be the saddest, scariest thing ever.
Yeah, I mean... But it's really great. Like, I don't know the time codes here, but going from the ridiculousness of the fighting at the table to the mom, you know, wailing over her dead daughter, you know, it's pretty quick.
Yeah.
Aaron goes upstairs and begins locking all the doors and windows. And she also texts 911. Nobody can get a signal in the house. And Felix suggests that there's probably like some signal jammer. And Drake's like, "You scumbag!"
An arrow in his back. He's like, "Of course you know that." Dude!
Paul takes Aubrey upstairs to lie down. Crispin is a little troubled, by Aaron's taking control of the situation. And he says, "I've never seen you like this." And she says, "Well, it's a unique situation." Paul leaves Aubrey. This is kind of, I mean, I guess it's good. So they're, you know, he was saved for a little while, but I thought that's a little bit unrealistic.
Like, there's a
why would you leave your grieving wife alone?
Somebody has to be. Why would you leave anyone alone?
Yeah, yeah.
Together at all times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he leaves her, and we see someone make their way out from under the bed.
This is so creepy because we just see her on the bed and then just slowly like a hand comes out. Ooh, so spooky.
Okay, so in the credits, I think we have Tiger Mask, Fox Mask, and Lamb Mask. But when I watched the kill count for this, James referred to this character as Wolf Mask. So that's how I'm going to call him too. So it's Wolf Mask. He machetes Aubrey to death. When everyone finds Aubrey, "You're next" is written in blood on the wall. Of course, like, Paul is beside himself.
It's such a great shot because the machete is in her like at an angle, you know? It's really good. And like something about that bed, it already looked kind of like bloody in a way. Like there's something about that bed where it already looked kind of dingy a little bit, but then her on it, I don't know. I feel like that was a great bed.
Tiger Mask breaks the window downstairs and attacks Aaron, but she stabs his hand to the window pane with a knife. Pretty awesome. She's so great. Kelly is still upstairs with Aubrey's body. She's sort of in a fugue state herself. She looks under the bed slowly, and Wolf Mask jump scares her. She runs out into the night screaming, which
books it.
Honestly, I could totally see myself doing that.
Fuck this. I'm going to just try to go, you know.
I don't know where I'm going, but I'm just not going to be there. So Drake follows her, and his arrow runs into the piano wire. He pulls it out, looks at it, and faints.
At this point, I do like Drake. Like, like, he's such an asshole, but I don't know. I kind of love him.
Well, his only redeeming quality is he does love Kelly, his wife, you know?
And I feel like he's not mean to anybody who aren't his brothers. Like, they're the only ones that get it, but like, Aaron helps him a lot and he's just kind of like docile with her.
He's kind of a shit to Amy via Tariq. I mean, sort of like, well, you know.
But like, I feel like when it comes to his family, he's mean. But like anybody else, you know. Tariq
got it
because he was Amy's boyfriend.
Yeah. So Kelly runs to the neighbor's house. Tiger Mask with a crossbow follows after her. She comes across Eric's house, hears the music, and knocks and screams for him to let her in. And she comes down this hill and sees that this body is sitting upright on the couch. So she assumes that, you know, he's alive and, you know, and she's like screaming, please, please, please let her in. I'm sorry. This is Lamb Mask. The Lamb Mask killer punches her in the face. She falls backwards through the glass door. She sees that Eric is dead right before Lamb Mask kills her with the axe. He just sort of does this almost like golf swing into her head.
It's so scary because she's on her back and then she just kind of like turns her head and just sees what he's about to do. Oh god, that would be so scary.
And then Lamb Mask sits on the couch next to Eric's dead body.
This is one of the scariest parts to me. He's kind of just like taking a breather and like looking at her dead body.
Yes. Meanwhile, Crispin goes to his trunk and retrieves a cleaver, I think. Back at the house, Crispin says he's going to go and get help. He cuts through the piano wire and leaves the house. Erin says that she thinks one of the killers is in the house. Paul suggests going to the basement because there's no windows down there. But Erin says that's no good. They could just pour gas down the stairs and light a match.
Everybody's just kind of like, what? She's my favorite. She's like one of my top favorite horror female characters of all time. Like,
yeah, she's amazing.
I feel like there are men sometimes write badass women, but they're like not great. They're usually just some kind of like, I don't know, male action movie star, but they just put huge boobs and they make them scantily clad and sexy and they have no personality. They're just killing machines. But she's like, she's never sexualized in this film. She's like a nice, good person. Everything she does is to help others or herself, but she's also like so rational and smart. I just think she's a great character.
Me too. Z, Felix, and Paul are all in awe of Aaron's abilities. Aaron goes into the kitchen and grabs all kinds of weapons. As she walks into the room, Tiger Mask breaks the window, causing Aaron to fall and all the knives and everything to go scattering in front of her. But she overcomes him. She gets him on the ground and pulverizes that guy with a meat tenderizer.
So good. Just like really lets him have it.
Felix and Z look on. She takes off his mask. She's like, does anybody know this guy? And Felix says, well, it's kind of hard to tell. And it's screenwriter Simon Barrett. Paul is upstairs exploring and sees that someone has been staying in the house. He finds a sleeping bag, food wrappers, and a bottle of piss. The lights go out. Felix suggests Aaron go look for the fuse box alone in the basement. Felix jump scares.
We start getting sus of Felix. And
yeah, like, for sure.
Is there like so calm?
They're so calm. And also that whole thing about, like, somebody should make a run for it. Like, that, I was just like, where is that coming from?
Yeah, and, like, the fact that they didn't help her at all. Like, they just kind of stared and looked at her then. And she even says, like, thanks for the help. And they're like, well, looked like you had a hand. Or you had a good handle on it. But their behavior just doesn't make sense.
Right. Felix jump scares his dad. Paul is walking backward. He's just like, there are people in the house. They've been hiding. They've been watching us the whole time. And Felix is like, okay, dad. And he's like, you don't understand. You know, he's walking backwards straight into an attack by Wolf Mask, who slits him across the throat. Felix and Z watch Paul as he dies.
And this part is so sad to me because he's like leaning back, at least trying to look at them for some sort of like something. And they're just standing looking at him with like no expression on their face. That would be so sad and scary.
I don't think the guy who plays the dad is a very good actor, but I will say this is a very good death.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
So Z and Felix are just watching Paul die, and then Wolf Mask comes into frame. And Felix is like, really? You had to do that right in front of me? So now we know that Felix is in on this.
Well, I love Wolf Max, like, pulls out, like, a earbud and is like, sorry, did you say something?
I missed that. That's great. Lamb Mask discovers that his brother has been killed, and he flips that huge table in anger. He mourns for a minute, then straps on the crossbow and grabs the axe. Aaron, in the basement, is also arming herself. He hears her. When she looks through the keyhole, she sees an eye staring back at her. He slams through the door with an axe a la The Shining. When Drake says, hey, to Lamb Mask, Lamb Mask moves toward him. Aaron stabs Lammy with a tool in the back. And Lammy moves off. Drake asks where Kelly is. Aaron says she doesn't know.
And that's another thing I like about Aaron is, like, she's not, like, a perfect badass or anything. Like, there are scenes where she's, like, overwhelmed or, like, where there could have been moments where she would have been killed. Like, because no person could withstand all this. And also, like, she doesn't know. Like, she's not heartless. You know, she's not, like, your girl's dead. I feel like there are some characters who have this badassery who would be like this, but she doesn't know what to say. So she's like, I don't know where she is, even though they saw Kelly's dead body earlier.
Felix and Z come downstairs and lie to Aaron that Paul is okay. He just needed to lie down. They all head downstairs to get weapons. Aaron tells Z that she grew up on a survivalist compound. Z's like, good answer. Felix tells Drake that Kelly is dead. Oh, yeah, so there's this, Felix and Drake are in the basement alone. Drake's like, I gotta get out there. I gotta go find Crispin and Kelly. And Felix's like, dude, Kelly's dead. And Drake's like, what do you mean? And he's like, oh, you didn't know? Oh, I'm so sorry. Drake advances on Felix. Felix has something, you know, like a screwdriver or something extended out in front of him, and Drake, you know, runs into it. And so Felix does the only thing that's reasonable at that moment. He just like stabs him with all these other tools. He
just keeps going.
Like, I mean, it's really, and then he says
the acting by Felix, like he's so it's just the perfect mix of like, I'm not sorry to be killing you, but I wish I didn't have to do this right now. Like,
yeah,
I wanted you dead, but I don't want to see it. And I love this entitlement from him of just like, dude, you're killing your whole family. And yet he's like, did you have to do this in front of me? Like, still playing the victim as if you aren't murdering your whole family.
Yeah. And Felix is like, would you just die already? This is hard enough for me. But Drake falls down dead. Aaron and Z have been upstairs nailing nails into boards, and Aaron places boards with nails in them in front of the window. And Z at one moment has one of the boards in her hands. She's gonna like, I don't know, hit Aaron with it, but Aaron looks back at her at the last moment. Aaron goes upstairs to check on Paul, and Z unlocks the front door. Aaron finds that Paul is dead. Wolf Mask advances on her with the machete, and Aaron jumps through the window outside. I mean, from the second floor, just like... She has a piece of glass stuck deep in her thigh, and she pulls it out very slowly.
And you see just, like, you just see glass, but then when she pulls it out, you see how long the glass is.
Because I was like, she's moaning, and I'm like, did she break up her ankle? Like, what did she do? But yeah, that makes total sense. Lamb Mask shoots at her with the crossbow. She runs back into the house and locks the door. He goes to the house and sees the nail boards on the floor, but he doesn't see the ones that are right by the edge of the wall, and he steps on that board.
Oh, and the nails are so long, too.
Yeah. Upstairs, Z wants to fuck Felix on the bed next to his dead mom.
Like, literally on the bed with the cover over his dead mom. And then she's like, you know what? Basically, like, you're a pussy. And he's like, you know, I don't want to do this right now. And she's like, you never want to do anything fun.
So he leaves, and Z takes a ring off of Aubrey's finger and puts it on her own finger. Felix yells at the masked killers. Felix tries to bribe the killers not to kill him. Aaron hears everything. Aaron hears everything. I think I missed a part. But Aaron runs out of the house, and they give chase, but then she goes right back into the house through this open window, and Lamb Mask looks into that window, and she stabs him in the head, and then we get the iconic shot of her standing in the window with the axe in her hands. She then hooks up a booby trap for the axe to kill anyone who comes through the front door. Felix and the Wolf Mask argue. Aaron knocks out the light bulbs in the basement, but sets up her camera to shoot pics as the killer advances on her. He is blinded, and she knocks him down and machetes him to death. Felix shoots a crossbow through the window. He gives Z the crossbow. Felix grabs a pocket knife from his trunk. Aaron knocks the crossbow out of Z's hand, and then we have the fight in the kitchen. I didn't write down all the steps of it, but it's Aaron and Z and Felix in the kitchen. Felix gets his knife in Aaron's back, but she kills him with a blender on his head.
So good. Iconic.
There was another one. There was another blender death. Was that in Unfriended?
I don't remember. I do remember there's one really gross kind of blender death in Rec 3,
where a
hand milkshake thing that somebody puts in like a zombie's mouth or something. but love me a blunder death.
I'm not crazy about it, but I do like this next part because she takes the knife out of her own shoulder and stabs Z in the top of her head with it. It's just like one motion. Like, yeah, just amazing. And then there's a shot of her just like sitting like in between these two dead bodies. Yeah. Felix's cell rings. Aaron answers it, but she doesn't say hello. Crispin asks Felix if it's all done. And he says he's sorry he couldn't help, but
he's a pacifist.
He's a pacifist because I can't handle that violent stuff. And he's just like, it's freezing out here, man. I'm just coming inside. So Aaron walks into the room. And she's got the phone to her ear. And so he knows that she's the one who answered the phone. She has a knife in her hand. And then they have this confrontation. And she's like, what the fuck? You were in on this? Like, were you going to let me die? Were you going to kill me? And he's like, no. You were supposed to be the witness. That you were never supposed to be killed. And he's like, but how were we supposed to know that you're really good at killing people?
Which is kind of weird, by the way. Like, he says, like, you're weird. It's like, you're the biggest weirdo ever.
And he's like, actually, this is a silver lining because now I'm the sole inheritor of my family's estate. And, you know, he's going on and on about how, you know, he can wipe out all her student debt. You know, maybe they can get married. And she just, like, stabs him in the neck. And then, and he goes, why? And she goes, why the fuck not? And then she stabs him in the eye. Well, the police finally show up and shoot her in the shoulder because they've just seen her kill Crispin.
And I love the policeman is like in the window and he's just like, I need some backup. Like, he's like, what the fuck?
he walks in the front door. Aaron shouts out, no. And he sets off the booby trap and you're next. And blood splatters across the screen. Roll so credits. Good.
Okay, I misremembered it as him, like, shooting her in the head and her dying. So I'm really glad that she didn't die, because that would just be such a bummer after all that.
I think I read that was the original ending, but I'm glad that she didn't die. That would have really been a downer.
You know?
What phobia is that? Well, apparently, there's something called masklophobia, sometimes referred to as maskophobia. This usually involves children who have an irrational fear of masks, sometimes also involving people in costume clothing, mascots. And this is usually just for, like, young children or toddlers. The primary filming location was an antique home that had been empty for 12 years. Sharni Vinson and Wendy Glenn were actually roommates and best friends before and during filming. Both Joe Swanberg and Ty West, who play eldest brother Drake and Amy's underground director boyfriend Tariq, are two prominent mumblecore directors, a horror genre in which You're Next is also included. Okay, thanks, trivia nugget. The masks in this film inspired the masks in the video game Hotline Miami. Do you know that game?
I have heard of that game, and I've heard a lot of good things about it, but have never gotten around to playing it.
You know how when you, like, hear about something, and then that, like, you keep hearing about it over and over, and you've, like, never heard about it before? That Diablo game is all I hear about, like, on all kinds of podcasts. Yeah, I don't know what's going on with that. The majority of... Okay. When Crispin cuts the piano wire at around 47 minutes... The note that is heard is between a D sharp and an E.
Ooh, interesting.
Interesting. Simon Barrett, the Tiger Mask Killer, is also... Yeah, we already said that. Okay. The original opening, as scripted, featured an old man who finds his dog decapitated before he is killed. The producers requested this to be rewritten as the scene that appears in the film.
I think that's good. I feel like moviegoers, if the first thing they see is a dead dog, they'd be like, oh, fuck this movie.
Yeah. What does Letterboxd have to say about it? Ben Reyes gave it a half star. My sister, 30 minutes in, and with vehement disgust in her voice, okay, so what's the fucking twist? Lena gave it a half star. The acting is serviceable, but the characters are largely one-dimensional and unlikable, making it difficult to care about their fates. Gore and violence are excessive and gratuitous, lacking the finesse and artistry of the genre's greats. That being said, Your Next does have its moments of dark humor, and the masked killers are effectively creepy. It's a shame that the film doesn't fully capitalize on its potential, instead feeling like a forgettable addition to the already crowded horror canon.
I will say, sometimes I feel like the whole unlikable thing, like I said earlier, that's there is a way to go too far, and I think a lot of horror movie, a lot of slashers do that, but I don't think this one does it. I feel like they're just unlikable enough that you're not completely sad, but then other ones are likable. It's like, even though the parents didn't seem like the perfect parents, like, I don't think they deserve to die.
Yeah, I don't. I didn't want them to. I mean, like, so, you know, he was a marketing director for this, like, defense contractor. I mean, not great, but, yeah, you know.
But the mom seems just, like a very loving, neurotic, yeah, but that's not, like, a killable offense. And, like, I don't know. I feel like Drake, like I said, is, like, you know, he's a shithead, but there's sometimes when I watch movies that they make me so angry that I'm like, I'm not even enjoying this. But like, I was just laughing like during those times. And I feel like you do need a certain sometimes bit of unlikableness to make it so I'm not fucking depressed watching all these people die.
There was that one movie that we watched for Squad, Don't Breathe. And I didn't like any of those characters. I'm like, yeah, please. Until we find out the secret of the killer, and then I'm like, oh no!
Yeah.
Jeff gave it a half star. Dog shit fucking movie. Everyone in this movie sucked at their job, whether it was killing or surviving, 0 out of 10.
Wow.
Wow. I thought that Aaron did a pretty great job.
Pretty awesome, actually.
Zephyr Renzo gave it a half star. So ass. Okay, so do you remember how I wanted to have a review in every show that was horrible? Or no, it's the new one is ass.
Jeff, okay, going back to Jeff, I feel like them sucking sometimes at killing or surviving, is that not more realistic? Like, the whole point of this is that everything went wrong and that the brothers were so fucking dumb, and a lot of real people do crimes like this or set up crimes like this where they just think it'll all be easy. I got it all figured out. And it's like, you don't. Like, nothing is ever that easy. And like, I like that the killers got killed because I feel like it was all fair. And like, if they're just like, if everybody's Michael Myers, it's not fun because then what do you even do, you know?
I do also really like the part where Tiger gets really upset that his brother has been killed.
He's a real person.
He's like, unlike you, you know, I love my brother, you know, and that wasn't supposed to happen. And yeah, I really like that moment. Nur gave it a half star. Stop shaking the fucking camera.
You wrote that review.
Yeah, I could have written that review. Diana NK gave it 5 stars. When life hands you lemons, watch a Barbara Crampton film.
I think it's kind of generous calling this a Barbara Crampton film. She's in like 5 minutes of the movie.
Sad's ADD girl. Okay, that's what I'm going to go with. Sad's ADD girl gave it 5 stars. Perfect movie to watch at a family gathering. Erin was so perfect in this. Oh my god, she's the top 3 final girl of all time. Like, she was eating.
She ate.
Girl was in action from the start. Like, girl was setting up traps and shit. I really hope she got her happy ending, but I guess we'll never know. This was like Home Alone on crack, TBH, but it's so good.
Yeah, the final trap did have a Home Alone vibe.
Yeah. Cheska gave it 5 stars. Now that is a fucking final girl. Aaron, I love you. You're a bad bitch. FKA Fievel gave it 5 stars. Comically dysfunctional family, mystery attackers in animal masks, and Australian. What more could you want? Delia gave it 5 stars. After this, and Ready or Not, I'm rethinking the whole marrying rich thing.
Yeah, they're probably crazy.
Ryan .. gave it 5 stars. Militant furries butchering a family of billionaire fascist Republicans. The leftist propaganda we all need.
It's like...
let's rate this in animal masks.
I'm going to give this one also a 4.
I will too. A 4.
Like, there's nothing really wrong with it, but also, as much as I do like it, there's also nothing, like, super crazy different about it. I mean, I feel like Aaron is the best part of this movie, obviously. And, I mean, it's nothing I dislike, but it's not, like, a perfect movie. But I can't pinpoint what that is.
I really wish the women hadn't been, like, offed so soon. Like, the mom and the sister are just, like, boom, boom. Like, they're out of it. And, you know, I really wish Kelly and Z hang around a little more, but
Z is so unlikable. Like, there's nothing.
Yeah.
I really wish they would have done her better. You could have had a really, I don't know, like, that kind of character you can do well.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. What have we learned from this movie?
Oh, man. I guess the whole marrying rich thing, maybe that's a good point, you know? Like, also, listen, you don't like your parents, you don't like your family, go no contact. Your dad, like, negging you is not an excuse to murder him, you know? And sure, money runs the world, but if you like money that much, you need to go to therapy.
Well, okay, that is one problem I do have with the fellowship comment, because if Crispin was in on the whole thing and he knew that the dad was going to be offed, like, later that night, why didn't he just say, yeah, I got it. Are you proud of me?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just for our benefit. So we understand a little more about the character, but I don't think that's very good writing. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, they could have conveyed that in just a different way of the dad making a comment. Like, you know, really, like, at dinner, maybe kind of humiliating him a little bit.
Yeah.
We only see why he would kill Drake, but we don't see, besides, again, the money, I kind of didn't understand also why he would get any of them else killed. Like, that he has no remorse about his mom dying.
He was going to split the money with Felix.
Well, yeah, but, like, the rest of his family, it's kind of like, why do you hate Amy?
Yeah, why do you hate, yeah, why do you hate your, yeah, well, I know, it's just the money. But, like, he says kind of pathetically, like, you know how much, you know, what a state we're in with money. Yeah. But,
The motivations didn't all the way seem there, because it's like, there are people who want money, but, like, to go to that length, you have to want them dead, you know? Like, and all of them dead? And also, in a way, it's kind of like, there's no other extended family members who might be on the will or anything.
And how, did you really think you were going to get away with it? Like, you're obviously going to be the prime suspects.
And that Aaron would, because there is a real case of something like this happening, of, like, it wasn't for inheritance, but this girl helped get her parents killed, but then her dad actually lived. Only her mom died. And it's actually really similar, because then she just had this plan and she just thought it would work. And whenever I watched this whole video of her getting interrogated by the cops, and, like, you just see how little she thought it through. So, I mean, I like that aspect. I feel like that's really realistic, but she killed her parents because they, like, were horrible to her whole life, which, again, not, you shouldn't kill people, but, like, that at least makes a little bit more sense than just, I wanted money, so I killed all of them.
Right. Yeah. Would we watch this again?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I'd watch it again. Do you have a favorite scene or a favorite death?
Man, I just love any scene. Maybe Aaron with the meat cleaver, because I thought that was just so badass. Any scene with Aaron and any scene with Drake. I did like the scene where he, like, just kept sticking things into Drake like that. I don't know. Scenes like that make me really like this movie, because, like, where have you seen something like that before?
Yeah.
Like, they feel real. Even though they're caricatures a little bit, it's like, that feels like a real thing someone would do, of just like, die, please!
Yeah. I'm trying to think. I mean, I like a whole lot of the scenes in this. I always forget about her jumping out of the window, so I guess I'll say that one. I was just like, damn, girl! She, like, really did that.
Yeah.
Who wins the You Fool Award?
Crispin?
I guess so. What a dummy. But also, Aubrey, because she had the right instinct in the very beginning.
That's true.
Door was unlocked and she heard the shit upstairs and she's like, we got to get out of here. And then she didn't, you know.
She must have, though, had a lifetime of her 35 years of being dismissed by her family.
I think so.
That really makes you think and question yourself. So they're the fools for not listening to her.
Yes.
So sad.
Well, thank you, Mac, for having this conversation with me about these two slashers.
Yes, thank you.
Uh-oh. One thing. Well, I guess this is true. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for joining. Well, host, thank you for joining us for this episode and for all your support. It means the world of horror to us, truly. Next time, it's Mom's Picks, and we will be looking at horror about possession. We will be looking at The Exorcist from the U.S. and The Wailing from South Korea. Next up on the world of foundational horror, I will be looking at Evil Dead Trap from Japan. Next up on the Quinisode is Gaslight from 1944. We would welcome your support in the form of a 5-star review or thumbs up on your preferred listening platform, but we will settle for you just telling all your friends all about us. On that, shout out to our wohos in various area codes. The last episode was downloaded in the U.S., Germany, Canada, India, and Honduras. If you'd like a specific shout-out, please get in touch. Mac, what do you have going on?
Well, as always, you can follow me on Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitch at Macaritaville.
Remember, wohos, we love you. And don't go into the basement.
Somebody could light a match and pour some gasoline down there and just throw it down.
Ha 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 ha!